How was lunch?
Yummy.
Cool. Yeah. Mars, too. Yeah. But I'm jealous because they went to Steak and Salt, which sounds really good. So we had some thoughts about some things that we want to talk about this afternoon, but we wanted to start with any thoughts you might have. Either things that just, one of the things about, and those of you who've been around these know, we don't just take breaks because we get bored, right? We take breaks because actually it's very often when you kind of walk away from the conversation a bit, that space, you kind of fall into that space where the new thought can come up. So the reason that I often like to come back after a break and check in is because it's very common for people to, something to have landed a bit over the break or for something new to have come up. So that's why we want to open the space up a little bit. So.
Joel. Yeah. Joel.
Can we get a microphone to Joel, please, Brian?
I'm Joel. during the first break, I was talking with Dickon, and I may be stepping back into my own mind trap again to ask this question, but I might as well exercise it from my brain. Talking about working with others and trying to convey some of what we've been talking about today. And Dickon, you made the point of, well, if you come from that space, I would, for my own terminology, I notice that authentic self space or whatever it is, that pre-thought space. Is there a way you might recommend centering yourself in that? I have a picture of how I might do that, but is there some sort of clear way of allowing that space to come forward before starting to work with somebody else? Some sort of like centering method?
You want the good news or the bad news first?
I'll just take news and I won't make any meaning of it.
Ooh, very nice. Well played, sir. Well played. All right. Well, you... There is no you and a space, right? We're talking about it like that to a certain extent as a way of trying to point to a truth. You are that space. So the idea that you could do something that would center you in that space, it makes no sense if we drop that conceptualization of it as two separate things. And as a more general point, and I know some of you have been on Super Coach Academy, who've been on trainings with Dickon or other teachers who've spent some time in the understanding, know those questions tend to fall away at some point the more you look in this direction, because you just see this is just what the world looks like. Once you get eyes for it, once it gets on your eyeballs, you just see this is what people are doing. When you get out of your own head, you see everybody else in theirs. And then you see those moments where they drop out of their heads and into their hearts, when they drop out of their conceptual frameworks, their beliefs, and into that space that beliefs are made of and from and through. And it's the most natural thing in the world to talk about it because you can see it. It would be the difference between you having come to a lecture on flowers and going, how could I tell other people about flowers? And you having a bunch of flowers and talking about them. When you've got the flowers, it's easy enough to talk about them. It's only when you think you don't have the flowers or you don't think you don't know what flowers look like, then it's like, well, how do I tell people about flowers? These things are beautiful. As opposed to, okay, there's a richness of color. There's an extraordinary geometry or better still, you want to know about flowers?
Yeah.
Right? That's how you do it.
So kind of when I get to a level where I don't even need to define it or think of myself as not being in it, that's probably the...
Look, I want to be fair, because I spent 3 solid years asking everybody those questions, and being slightly frustrated by the answers that I was getting. So I'm really not trying to be clever and mystical and shit. It's just, it doesn't work that way. It isn't a thing that you can get good at talking about. It's something. I used to watch these guys. The first set of videos that went really mainstream were some videos that our friends Rudy and Jenny made, a series of interviews with all the big teachers of the three principles. And when I was first learning, I got very excited to see these videos. And each person that they interviewed, there was one video called "What Are the Three Principles?" And that was the video on which they were the most inarticulate, the most seemingly baffled and lost in their speaking. Dickens, if I'm remembering correctly, actually begins with him going, right? And I
in my great intellectual brilliance.
And I remember thinking, this is the name of your freaking field and you don't have an answer to that question? But now I get it. You want to. The Sanford Meisner, the acting teacher, apparently had a sign in his office that said, "I would the stage were as narrow as a tightrope dancer's wire, that no incompetent would dare step upon it." There are times where I wish words weren't so easy to use, so that I wouldn't be so tempted to talk about this space inside so lightly and so easily and so like I know what I'm talking about. But it's what I got. As you get intimate with this, you will find ways of attempting to introduce other people to that in them, because you won't be able to imagine anything you could do for them that would be more of an act of love, that would be more helpful, that would be more of service. And you won't care if you do it well or badly until after, when you start thinking about it. Because you have such respect for what it is that you're talking about. That's my best attempt now.
In every next layer of explanation you've given me really strikes something inside that I feel that I can't describe, that I feel is likely it. Or
yeah, I was going to say, that's it.
And then also in your answer, I think I may have asked the question slightly different from what you were attempting. What I was wondering was not how can I be sure I'm bringing it to the other person that way? How can I access that space prior to the conversation with the other person?
You don't have to.
You don't have to.
My answer is you just show up.
And
your level of understanding, when you show up, you're either going to be present or you're not. You can't do anything about that. Right? As your understanding deepens, you do tend to show up more of the time with nothing on your mind or less on your mind. Or you could care less if you're not present at times. There's plenty of times when I sit with people, I'm totally not present. I'm distracted and, I'm maybe a little easier for me to recognize when that's happening and to fall back into the present moment, right? But you just show up and you do the best you can. And as your understanding deepens, you see things different, you say things different, you respond differently. But until that shifts, you're gonna you can't do any better than what you know. So another way Sid would say it is keep it ordinary. And just share with people what you know. Listen, and then share with people what you know. Nothing else is that simple. So then there's no prerequisites for the session. There's no prerequisites for how you show up. You know, sometimes I say to a client, I'm so distracted, I'm sorry. I'm just like, I can't hear you today. Could you say that again? Ah, thanks, okay. And you do the best you can. You show up as a come-as-you-are party is how I like to say it. You're in a shitty mood, you show up, and you say, I'm not in such a great mood. Let me see if I can get present with you. What's going on?
I sat down with a friend a couple of years ago now, and she asked me to be with her because her husband had a heart attack at quite young, unexpectedly, and she was just shit scared. And when she initially asked, I was like, of course. And then in the 2 days between when she asked and when we were going to meet, my world fell apart a little bit. And I was just all over the place, and I was all up in my head. And I was going to cancel, because I just thought, I am in no state to help somebody else with their problems. I can't deal with mine. But something in me, I'll call it wisdom, said go anyways. And so I went. And I sat down, and she told me about her shitty life. And then I told her about my shitty life. But when I finished, I realized something, and I shared that too. I said to her, I said, the only difference between you and me is I know this is thought, and it's going to look different in the morning. And you think this is your life, and it's always going to be like this. And that was pretty much the only thing that occurred in that conversation verbally that you could call a coaching bit. Well, she wrote to me that evening, and she, you know, just with an incredible gratitude, and she was in a completely different place, and she was seeing it completely differently. And that was sort of a lesson to me about It's a Come As You Are party. I didn't pretend to have it together. I didn't pretend to be in a great place, and it was perfect. Now, maybe if I'd been in a great place, it would have been perfect differently. I don't think I had to be in that state of mind either, but I was. However little you think there is to do, there's even less to do, because it's all there. Thanks, Joe. Yeah, Jan.
I've been working as a coach for 10 years. And when I meet with clients, I always expect with myself that I have to use some tools. So it's the NLP, it's the hypnosis, and this and that. And I also had an experience with a client that I was starting talking like you do, but not in the same level. And she was actually saying to me, aren't you going to do something? So how to change the... I know it's easy to say think, but I'm not sure if how to really to go from this to that. You understand my...
Tell you how it happened with me, because that was exactly my background, that was exactly my training, and it seemed like a big deal to me. Right? And part of why it was a big deal was because I was still telling people that what they were going to get was what I used to do, and then I wasn't doing that anymore. So part of it was just I hadn't adjusted the way I talked about what we were going to do. But part of it was I wasn't really sure that that wouldn't help anyways. So I got that this was better, but I thought that a little bit of both might be the best. And so that's what I did. Of course that's what I did. That would be common sense. If you think the two together are going to be great, that's what you're going to do. Even if you think, maybe I should only be doing that. I just always did what I thought was best. There came a point where it was painful to me to try and drag somebody through a technique when I could see they were already there. But for their thinking, but for that being lost in space, you know, in this space. And at that point, I actually said to the last client I still had, because I wound up telling all my clients, I wound up giving them a choice. I said, look, I can't do this anymore. I can give you the rest of your money back or come with me. And it was about half and half. And the last guy I was holding out with, because the techniques really seemed to help him. So I was like loath to take that away from him, because it was helping. And I finally just, I just couldn't do it. And I said the same thing to him. And I was very surprised he came along. And honest to God, within two sessions, he was like I was coaching a different guy. And then I never looked back. Then it never, as a friend of mine said, who came out of the NLP world, he said, you know, if it occurred to me in a session to do a technique, I would do it. But I notice it hasn't occurred to me in about 3.5 years. So it's not thou shalt not or anything like that. It's you've got to go with wisdom. And it just, my experience has been, it's, you know, and I'll, last little anecdote, because I know you've got a wealth of experience on this, but I do remember the first client who I just wasn't going to go there at all with. And you know, at that time, it was still, you know, I did a year-long program. It was 50 grand. That was all I did. So he, in the second session, he said, "Hang on. So you're telling me I just paid you $50,000 so that we could get together every couple weeks and have a chat?" And I was like, and I thought about it, and I went, "Well, yeah." And I went, "Okay." And his life changed. I mean, the problem was in my thinking, not his. He thought it was a little weird, but he was, you know, people don't care how you do it. They want a better life. They want a richer experience of being alive. They want to get on with their kids. They want their marriages to be better. They want to be more successful at work. You know, we've got a friend who brought the principles into, and I know Dickon did a lot of work in his company, to this huge company. And the company was spending hundreds of thousands on training in the principles. And when this was brought to the attention of the big boss, the big boss said, "Well, they're outperforming everybody else at the company. So if they want to pay money to go sit in the woods and sing Kumbaya, we're in." I was actually very embarrassed on a training in England, because on one of the evenings they threw in an optional session that I hadn't known about it, where people sat around in a circle and sang Kumbaya. And up until that point, I'd always been able to say, "No, we don't do that." And I was like, "Damn."
The deeper I too taught nothing but techniques. I had 10 years of working as a psychologist, and I studied so many different systems and so many different ways of helping people. And my attitude was, I'm eclectic, which means I'm open-minded, which means I'll use with people whatever I think might work. Right? Then I go to my training and I find out that every problem a human being has is created from thought. And every solution that people find that works for them comes from their own wisdom. But I didn't see that intellectually. I started to experience that in my own life. So like at the night of the first training, I went back to my hotel, and I'm hearing about thought, and I'm hearing about wisdom and common sense. And I go back to my hotel room, and it's like, oh, geez, it's late, and I got a lot of emails to respond to, and I've got all these problems, and I start... And then I saw myself thinking up, and I went, oh, could that just be thought? And it fell away, and I said, oh, my God, it can't be that easy. And then I felt better. Still same problems, still same issues, but my thinking changed. So I felt better. And I tell you, anytime you feel better, you get wiser. So most people say, I can't relax until I solve this problem, then I can feel better. Rather than, when I feel better, solving the problem will be a piece of cake. So in that sense, everybody puts the cart before the horse. And then they wonder why it's so difficult to go somewhere. But you have to see it for yourself. And the more you see it for yourself, the more it becomes, what else would you tell people? It doesn't matter what people present with. I know that the way they think about their life is creating angst and anxiety or worry or depression or upset. I know that's the source of their experience now. It's created from thought. So why would I talk to them about it? If they want to understand why they feel the way they do, why wouldn't you tell them all feelings are created from thought? That's true. It's always been true. It's always going to be true. There is no other source of experience. And then I couldn't believe it. I started in my very first sessions with people, when I would talk that way with people, they would come back and say, I can't believe it. My wife and I didn't fight last night, and I started to get upset, and then I just didn't go there. Can't be that easy. It is that easy. And you have to find out for yourself. I mean, we talk about wisdom. They're words, and it doesn't mean anything until you discover that when your mind clears, things occur to you that help you and surprise you. You have to find that out. It doesn't do any good to take anybody else's word for it. Little Sid Banks story. Sorry, he's just a guy. And he's an ordinary guy. And this story is not about him. It's about all of us because we're all ordinary people. And it works the same way for us as it does for anybody else. People heard about, there's a man in Canada who had an enlightenment experience, and he talks to you, and he doesn't tell you what to do, and he doesn't tell you what to think, and you listen to him, and your life gets better. So there's enough people in the world, when they hear that, they get on a plane, and they go, whoa, the seekers of the world, their ears, right? And they rush. So they get there, and Sid hated to talk about himself. And I had known Sid for like 10 years before he told me this story. He said, you know, Dickon, at one point, 200 to 250 people a day were getting off the ferry on the island where I live looking for me. And they were coming from all over the world, gurus and seekers and Buddhist monks and people who had spent their lives in mental institutions and just anybody and everybody who wanted to have more well-being. He said, you know what I told them? Go home. You can't get wisdom from another person. It doesn't work that way. No one can give you wisdom. You already have it. Deep inside your consciousness, deep inside of you, in that quiet, that's where you find wisdom. And that's the only thing that's going to solve your problems, answer your questions. That's where you find love. That's where you find everything a human being is looking for. That's where they find it. So go home. You live in the world of thought. You have this deeper intelligence waiting to break through in the quiet, open moments of your mind. It's already breaking through. The sun is already working perfectly. It already is shining through in your life. But most people, when they feel better, don't go, well, there's wisdom shining through. They go, well, I'm feeling better because the sun came out. I'm feeling better because you were kind to me. I'm feeling better because it's my favorite TV show on TV. I'm feeling better because, after all, it's a sundae, my favorite ice cream, right? It's not, because you can put your favorite ice cream in front of somebody, and if they're worrying, they don't go, ah, this feels great, right? They made a joke about that, FedEx. You know the notion they asked business executives, when do you get your best ideas? Now, I think you'll understand why they have these answers. They said they get their best ideas when they're in the shower, when they're driving around in their car listening to music, and when they're on vacation. What do all three of those have in common? There's just an openness in your mind you're not holding on to, you're not trying to figure out, you're not analyzing, you're just relaxed and open, and that's when people get their best ideas. So FedEx did a funny story. They showed all these business executives in their company with ties on and coats, and they're all getting into the shower, saying, well, we got to get some good ideas, so we're having our meeting here in the shower. It was so perfect. I laughed so hard. Now, this may sound funny, but we've been living in superstition for centuries so that we think, like, for example, poets thought the muse had to do with something in the world. So, like, there was one poet who said, when I soak my feet in hot water, I do my best thinking and I write my best poetry. So he couldn't write poetry unless his feet were in a tub of water. That's no different than I saying, well, I can't feel good until it's Friday. That's superstition. It's a misunderstanding about where feelings come from. If you knew that every good feeling that you have came from inside of you and not from what you did or what was outside of you, it changes the landscape. It means I could be in a horrible situation. If my mind is open, I will feel better in spite of myself and in spite of my circumstance. Right? So the more you begin to see your experiences independent of circumstance, the freer you become, the more empowered you become as a human being.
So just to show you that at least I haven't stopped being an idiot, I notice that there are things that I do that sometimes when I do them, it's an expression of wisdom. It's an expression of this deeper mind. And sometimes when I do them, it's because I'm shit scared and I'm trying to comfort myself. Prayer is one of those things. I'm not a big prayer guy, but I pray from time to time. And when I pray, I've come to see. Some of the time, it really is just an expression of gratitude and an invocation of hope. And sometimes I'm scared and I'm going, okay, you do it, right? It's a completely different feeling. It has a completely different effect. Superstition is just an expression of a misunderstanding if you take it to heart. If not, it's just a thing we do, right? So this morning, I'm feeling a little out of sorts, a little tired. We had a late night last night, and I woke up early this morning. And I'm thinking, oh man, you know, I got to drive in. We got a lot to do today. I go and I shave, and I've got this thing of aftershave that Elsie Spittle brought me, that was made by somebody who used to be with Sid in the early days. And I thought, if I use the Sid aftershave, it's gonna go great. Now, I knew that it probably doesn't work that way. But I used the Sid aftershave nonetheless.
That's great. You have to understand that when you have understanding, it doesn't mean you get to do things perfectly. Like if you're learning how to ride a bicycle, it doesn't mean that you're never going to fall over again. Even though you can ride a bike anywhere, or there are certain times when you seem like it's hard to stay on, right? My wife and I bought a two-person kayak. I'm extremely excited. We had been canoers our whole life. The very first present my wife and I bought together was a canoe. You know, and we just love canoeing. And so we go out to the west, and we notice nobody in the west coast has canoes. And we say, well, sissy them. And we get out in the ocean with our canoe, and the wind picks up, and all of a sudden we're 3 miles down the coast. We're going, holy Jesus. And we look at these guys with the low slung round kayaks, and we go, oh, insight. We bought a kayak the next day. All right, we get it. They're really wise design. So we get this kayak. We're all excited. We get it up on the roof of the car. My phone rings. I answer it. It's a client in crisis. My daughter had come over, and we were going to take turns in the kayak, and she was all excited, and she loves boating. And so I said, listen, it probably won't take me more than half an hour, but I really need to talk to this client. You guys go on down to the beach, right in front of our house. Just 1 minute drive down to the beach. And stay close to shore and where I can see you, and I'll be down soon, and I'll wave to you, and you come in. So I talk to the client, finish the call, run down to the beach, and I look out, and I can't see him. And I have the thought, they've gone too far out. There's treacherous currents if you go too far out, really treacherous currents, known. They got caught in this current or they flipped over. The ocean water is like freezing cold. It doesn't matter if you're the best swimmer in the world, which my wife and daughter are. I really started thinking they might be out there dying or dead. I freaked. I totally, remember you experienced your thinking? You can't not do that. And sometimes you're aware of that, and sometimes you're not. When you're not, it seems like it's the situation creating your experience. When you are, it changes the landscape. Right? I didn't see it. I didn't realize I was caught up in my thinking about this in a way that was creating this experience. I freak out. I don't know what to do. I think I better run home and call the Coast Guard. That's where I went. I better go call the Coast Guard. Well, what if they're out there? Maybe I'm not seeing them. Maybe they're right out there and I can't see them. And I run home, grab the binoculars, run back to the top of the cliff, and I'm scanning everywhere and I don't see them and I'm panicking. And I run down to the beach again and I'm looking everywhere, and all of a sudden they come paddling around the corner. And I am pissed. I mean, I am ripshit. I am really upset. You know, like, I told you to stay within sight. And at that moment, I realized I was in a huge thought reaction. And as soon as I realized that, I knew it was probably not in anybody's best interest for me to stay there while I was in that state. So that little bit of openness in my mind brought in enough common sense for me to walk home. Later on, my wife and daughter said, as we were paddling in, we saw this old man walking up the hill toward our house. That was me. Right? So I go home, and I go, I know I'm in a thought reaction. I know there's nothing wrong with that. It happens to everybody. See, you get your sanity back. If you know you're insane, you're not insane. It's when you think you're onto something, you're in trouble. You see? That's when people are ripshit. They think they're right. They think it's true, and they act on it. And that's the only time human beings get into trouble. Right? So I knew I was insane. And I'm just waiting until my thought storm passes. And I'm not trying to do anything. I'm not trying to get present. I'm not... all my old strategies to center myself or to, you know, say a mantra, or, you know, I wasn't using any strategy. I'm just waiting. I know it's going to pass. So I'm pretty calm until they walk in the door. And I see them. And in spite of myself, I go, you could have at least listened, you know. I mean, geez, I thought you were dead. They both immediately, this is the benefit of in a family of everybody sort of knowing this, they knew I was in a low state, and that don't take to heart what he's saying while he's in this low state. He's just upset. It's not personal. It's not personal. So they both just listened to me rant for a while, and they said, oh, really sorry. But they knew enough not to engage, not to try and work it out then, not to try and talk about it then. And they just sort of left me alone until I got over it. After I got over it, I started laughing at how humorous I had been. I mean, I was nuts. And I went to him, I said, I am so sorry, oh, geez. Wow, did I lose it? I just didn't see it. You know what my daughter said? She said, oh, Dad, don't worry about it. I knew you were just caught up, and it's no big deal. It's no big deal. She said, actually, I was doing everything I could not to laugh. She says, I can't remember the last time that you really lost it like that. I mean, you were funny. I mean, it's been so long since I've seen you really angry. And I said, well, thanks for being understanding. It sucked. You see, this is after many, many, many years of studying the principles and 13 years of being with Sid Banks. Here's the deal. You see it sometimes. You realize you're living in a spiritual reality and that life is creating your experience. And you see that and realize that some of the time. But because it's spiritual and invisible, you don't see it a lot of the time. And when you don't see it, you get caught up in your thinking and it seems real, and you act on the basis of that thinking. You're just doing the best you can. Right? I know for a fact that when my wife is in a low mood, if she opens her mouth, it's going to come out negative. It used to all the time bug me when that would happen. I'd say, why do you have to be that way? And now I realize, well, you're human and everybody is that way, me too. When I open my mouth, when I'm in a low state, it comes out negative. It's just the lower you go in consciousness, the more judgment is in your thinking, so it's always going to be more negative. Right? So the spiritual teaching is it's normal to drop down into low states. It's normal to have negative thinking. And if you're aware of it, you don't have to take to heart what you're thinking. Now, here's what that means. If I right now put dark sunglasses on each one of you and you didn't understand how that worked, you might go, oh my God, it's must be 10 o'clock at night. What are we doing still here? Oh my God, I missed dinner. Now, I think that happens to human beings every day. They get into a low mood, they're looking through the dark filter of their negative thinking, and they think they're seeing life accurately. You see, that's the trick. You get tricked by your thinking and think it's true. So the spiritual teaching is when you feel shitty, if you realize it, don't take to heart what you're thinking. It's distorted, it's negative. Wait a little bit, it'll pass, you'll come up. This is what's behind when you're angry, count to 10. Well, that only works if you stop thinking about what you're doing. It's not, you can be angry and count to 10 and get more and more angry if you keep thinking about it. You see, so it's like when you begin to see you're always looking at the world through a thought filter and you can't help it. And when you're in a clear head, you're seeing life clearly as it is. And the lower you go in consciousness, the more you're looking at the world through the filter of your own negative concepts, beliefs, ideas. And one way of defining the way Sid Banks talked about psychological struggle, difficulty, all it is for any human being is you get into low state and you think that how you see things or that what you think is true. You know what mental health is? You go into a low state and you don't think that what you're thinking about yourself or your life is true. You don't think your doubts, your worries, your judgments are true. You can tell by the feeling that they're distorted. And that when you come up here, you get clearer. Right? It's just how life works.
It's I used to think when I was in my depression years, I genuinely thought that when I was up, I was deluded. But what I was thinking when I was depressed was how I really felt about things. That was reality. And yeah, I had these delusional moments where I thought it was all going to be okay. Yeah. It really didn't dawn on me that it could be the exact opposite of that. That when I was clear, not necessarily up, but just clear, I was clear. And when I was in a low mood, I had a certain habitual thoughts that would come again and again and again, and that was creating that experience. And I didn't know that. And I look back on the biggest insights and breakthroughs I had in my life, and I marvel at the fact that wisdom was working before I knew there was such a thing as wisdom. Right? I tell the story in the TED Talk of you know, the night that I realized that I didn't want to commit suicide. It was just a thought. It was a suicide thought. I didn't know about any of this, but I saw that.
Yeah.
I saw that clear as day. And that, like, what am I so scared of? It's just, you know, it's just this thought that comes in when I'm having a tough time.
Mm.
Right? Mm. That's what, to me, is so beautiful about this, is it's a description of a pre-existing truth. It's not something you have to learn. It's something that the reason it's worth describing it and having it described is you can look for yourself and see. Because when you see it, it's obvious. When you see it, it's like, oh, thank God for that. It was just a dream. Right? You know dreams where you're not quite sure when you wake up if it happened in your dream or if it really happened? I, to this day, am mostly convinced I didn't kill somebody who's buried under a shack in Louisiana because I only went to Louisiana for the first time recently. But I'm like, you know, there are a few things. It's like, wow, that seemed real. But it's like that all the time. It's not like there's quite that delineation between sleep and waking that we think there is. And for me, it's like there are times, I don't know if this is a real progression. In fact, I know it isn't a real progression. I'm gonna make a reality now. I'm gonna construct a reality, okay? And in this reality that I'm constructing, there are levels of waking up. You can wake up to the fact that you're dreaming. So you can become aware that you're in a dream. And that just gives you a little bit of space. Doesn't really change anything, but just things don't weigh quite what they weighed a moment ago. You can wake up in the dream, and then it's a lucid dream, and you have powers, seemingly. Like, stuff just flows for you, and it just happens. And you can sort of do things that other people say, you can't do that. And you go, well, apparently I can, right? And you can, in my experience, I can say, for a heartbeat, from what I've heard of people like Sid's experiences for a lot longer, you can wake up from the dream and see the spiritual reality and then go back to sleep. But there's no version where you don't go back to sleep. There's just different degrees of wakefulness in and around the dream. Well, that's just the deal. So there's no point in my mind in like going, oh, I want to wake up. You know, it's like, no, you're awake and you're awake and you're asleep when you're asleep and you're more asleep sometimes and more awake sometimes and you do your best. And it turns out to be a great life, right? What a fun thing to suck at, life.
You know.
And, you know, when it comes to creating, right, when it comes to creating things, what a fun thing to suck at. I don't know, let's try this. You know, and you learn as you go, and there's something about that playfulness, that freedom of movement, that freedom of thought, that you tend to do better. You tend to learn quicker because you don't take yourself out of the game so often. You don't get lost in here, and you spend more time in that flow place in you, and things go better. And you learn quicker, and it's just fun. Now, for me, when I used to have conversations with George Pransky about creating. And in my mind, I was for it, he was against. Right? That's how it seemed to me. It's like, because he would talk about things like, well, it's either in the cards or it isn't. Oh, that made me mad. Like, no, he didn't understand. If you're empowered, it doesn't matter if it's in the cards. You can deal yourself a new... You know, I just... Oh, man, I didn't know what I was talking about, but I was talking loud. Right? And he would say, I'd say, come on, George. You're telling me you don't have goals? And I go, well, I have pipe dreams. And I just could not get my head round because I was so from a believe and achieve mindset, conceive, believe, achieve, that I just thought he was this poor, self-limited man who somehow had this amazing life and helped all these people despite himself, right? Whereas I'd earned everything I had, right? I mean, now I look back and I see how everything super cool that has happened in my life happened because I kind of pipe dreamed about it. I kind of daydreamed about it. Sometimes I hadn't even dreamed about it, and it was apparently in the cards because it happened. When I used to audition, right, I never understood, because 9 times out of 10, the parts that I got were not parts where I'd auditioned the best or been particularly prepared. Sometimes it felt like they'd given me the job before I walked in the room. Other ones that I'd prepared for and worked at, and I'd go in and I'd try and understand, well, now what could I have done differently? And they go, nothing, we just didn't give you the job. You know, and I was like, no, there must be a reason. And now, of course, I can hear myself. I can look back and I go, no, that's how everything works. And then that just makes the idea that I need to go out and make it happen just not feel right anymore. Used to feel right, so I used to try to do it. doesn't feel like that's how it works in the same way. I have to show up. I haven't found a way to do it without showing up, but maybe even that's a belief. But that seems to be, it really seems to be helpful if I'm in the room. But I'm not convinced that anything else I do helps other than respond to what shows up, other than be available, be in relationship with this movement inside me. And what I notice is that, do mind if I share a story? I want to share a story of a contrast between my first book deal.
Good, yeah.
Which was miraculous, the way it unfolded, but I didn't think it should work that way. And my newest book deal, which was kind of miraculous and cool, but it's exactly how I thought it should be. So I had wanted to write a book for a while, and I thought I should write a book, to be honest. It was because a couple of my students from NLP had written books, and I was like, well, they learned that from me. I should write a book. And I had a couple of goes, and it didn't really happen. And I had an experience that I was telling Dickon about with this cab driver named Adolf. And it's in the first book. And I just realized, oh, I really want to write a book, but I thought I'm going to do it right this time. I'm going to hire a coach. So I talked to Cheryl Richardson and a few other people that I'd met, and I said, who should I hire if I want to write a book? And everyone gave me one name, so I went to hire, and the way it worked is you paid her whatever it was, and she would read a proposal and a sample chapter and your platform statement, like why people would buy your book. And if she thought you were worth her time, she would coach you. And I was pretty confident because I had ghosted books, I'd edited books. I knew, you know, I wasn't concerned, oh, I can't write. Well, she said to me, essentially, I always use the analogy of Fred Astaire's screen test. You know the story? So Fred Astaire, his first screen test, there's actually, you can find it on the internet, it's at can't act, can't sing, balding, can dance a bit. Right? And so he was right into the reject pile. It worked out okay for Fred. Right? Well, that was kind of her critique of my writing. It was like, well, I don't think you understand what it takes to actually make it as an author. You seem to have much too lighthearted an approach, like this is just going to happen, like you're not going to have to put the slog in. But your writing's not bad. So if you're willing to take on this 21-point action plan, and she said, and I'll be honest with you, it's only your writing that's even keeping me in conversation with you about it. We can get you, within a year, we can get you an agent, within 2 years, a deal, and within 3 years, you'll have a book on the shelves. Take a week to think about it. Now, I was crushed, because I really thought I was the great white hope, and that she was going to go, oh my God, where have you been all my life? Finally! And I knew I wasn't going to do the 21-point plan. That was very obvious to me. But I just thought I should give it a week. So that was wisdom. I didn't know that was wisdom. I thought that was kind of delaying my losership. Right? I'll put off being a loser and a wimp and dropping out for a week and see if I feel differently. Well, on the Friday of that week, it was Monday I had the meeting, on the Friday of that week, I kind of woke up and thought, you know what? Nothing in my life has ever worked the way it's supposed to. I don't see any reason why this is going to be different. I'm going to write it. And if nobody reads it, nothing ever happens, I've written a book. So again, I just saw that as a random act of hopefulness. Right? I didn't see, well, no, I made space. I left it. I let it, all my thinking about it, settle. And in that space, something from that deeper space, that truth within that deeper consciousness came through. And it just occurred to me as an idea, yeah, I'm going to do it. On the Saturday, a client I hadn't talked to for a couple of years, who used to be head of publicity for MTV Europe, said, hey, I've been thinking about you. It's crazy that you're not a bigger deal. Have you ever thought of writing a book? I said, well, funny you should mention that. Just yesterday I decided, and she said, well, let me talk to some people. Let me set up some meetings for you when you're next over. I'm like, now again, now I would go, of course that's how it works, right? Because when you move, the universe moves too. That just seems to be how it works. But then it was like, this is weird. The Sunday, I get a call from my friend Paul McKenna. Some of you know Paul, best-selling self-help author in the world. I'd edited some of his books. So he calls me up and he said, "Hey, I was with my literary agent at a party last night. We were talking about you. He heard your CDs and he really liked them. You know, he's interested. Have you thought of writing your own book?" I said, "Well, funny you should mention that." Now I'm kind of like going, okay, this is weird. Right now it's not weird, it's cool. Because this is something that always happens. It's not that I can predict what's going to happen, but it's damn predictable something is when you start moving with this movement. Well, 3 weeks later, I signed with the agent. 3 weeks after that, Hay House signed me to a 2-book deal. 1 year, 1 month after the meeting with the original coach who told me 3 years I might have a book on the shelf if I changed my life and who I was number one on the bestseller list in the UK. And I still didn't get it. I thought, wow, that was weird. And then carried on trying to set goals and make things happen and do them the way I'd always taught people to do them. Well, over time, I started to see this is just how it works. We open ourselves up to a deeper wisdom. And that wisdom has an intelligence. It's creative. And sometimes it feels like, you know, you talk about wisdom having her way with you. I feel like sometimes I get impregnated by wisdom. And sometimes I'm just the midwife. But I'm never the man in this one. Right? You know, it's just the way it is. And now, so what happened this time around? I got the sense last September that there was something brewing. I was ready to write something new. Been a couple of years since Inside Out Revolution. And it wasn't I should write the next book, and the publisher had said, you should write another book, but I didn't. But this was the first time where I kind of felt, and I kind of knew I wanted it to be 2 books. I wanted it to be, and I wanted the third one, so Inside Out Revolution being the first of a trilogy, I wanted the third one to be Creating the Impossible. And the middle one was the one about this. Mm-hmm. It was the one about this space inside. But I didn't have the language for it, and I had a lot of thinking about it. And I knew by then not to try and make it happen, not to set a goal, not to put a time frame on it, not to just to kind of just stay with it and let it unfold. Well, one of the things that occurred to me is, boy, I'd love to talk with Elsie Spittle about this. Now, Elsie and I, at that point, we hadn't spent much time together, but we were friendly. I knew she'd loved Inside Out Revolution and had been very kind to me about it. So I figured, and none of the dates that we had talked about could work. And she finally said, well, look, I can come out in May and, you know, and do this thing because I decided to do this series. And so it was great. Well, okay, we'll do that. Well, what started to happen, as I expected it would, because now I was wise to it, was I would get little ideas from time to time, just because I was kind of, even though I wasn't thinking about it, it was thoughts were coming. And I'd get little ideas and little frames, and I even knew, I taught a Thrive weekend the weekend before Elsie was due to come out. And I was talking there, and I said, you know, it's almost there, this middle book, this next book. And I just, it's not quite there, but it'll come next weekend when Elsie's here. And they're like, I just knew. And I even got, like, I got a chapter outline when I was waiting for my bag at the airport, and boom, download, chapter. Elsie came. You guys, some of you were here. There couldn't have been a more perfect weekend for this book. It was just an experience of what I was trying to describe in the book. I spent some time with Elsie. I got very clear. Again, I still didn't try to make a deal happen. I just was aware, okay, now I know what I'm talking about. I'm comfortable enough with this to present it. I did think I should write it up, but I didn't, because I know that thought isn't of this same energy. So then I called my agent up, and I said, hey, there's a book almost ready to happen. Can we have a chat, just chat it through? Because I kind of knew chatting it through would bring it more into form. It would bring it more out of here, from here, out of here, out into here. And we had a chat. We came up with some ideas, but it still wasn't quite right. He said, you know, why don't you go away and think about it? Because I don't want to pitch it like this. Yeah. Well, then in May, was it May when I was over? So in May, I was asked to speak at the Hay House Writers Workshop, and I was speaking, and it happened that the head of Hay House was the other speaker, and so it went really well. It was going really well, and I just, without even knowing it, without having thought about it, without meaning to, I said, "Hey, can I talk to you at lunch? I've got an idea I want to run by you." And then in my head, I went, "Oh, I guess I'm going to pitch the book." And then I sat down with him at lunch, pitched actually three books. Completely to my surprise, they not only went for the books, they went for the launch schedule that I wanted, and they offered me more money than I'd ever made. It was like this. Now, the only difference, I was still kind of like, God, this is cool. But it was actually now I understood this is just how it works. It wasn't special. It wasn't because I did something right. I visualized the right things. I thought that. It was just, I just allowed it. I didn't fuck it up. Right? That's the astronaut's prayer. Literally was the astronaut's prayer. Dear God, don't let me fuck this up. That was what they used to say before they went into space. That was it. It was like, because it was just unfolding. I was along for the ride. That's my experience of what it is to be open to possibility as opposed to trying to make things happen. Discuss. Microphone to Brooke, please.
It just reminds me, at the office, we write grants all of the time, and we used to write grants with a lot of, like, we. And any other nonprofit I've worked at, we wrote grants like, we really need this one, we really need this one, and that's. But now, and it's all the staff, and it's such a great feeling because we write a grant, and if we don't get it, we're like, oh, I wonder what else is coming. So there's not a disappointment because we don't need the money because it's going to come from somewhere, and that's probably going to be way better than what we thought.
Yeah. And that, you know, George used to talk about becoming discouragement proof in sales. That if you're discouragement proof, if somebody saying no isn't discouraging, you're going to do really well at sales. Right? Because the only reason people don't is because every time it gets a little harder because you're carrying another layer of thought on top. Oh, God, what if this one? Oh, God, I'm never going to make it. Oh, God. You know, and so you know, by the end, you know, you're just going, I don't suppose you'd want to, never mind. Right? You know, you get. Whereas if you've got that clarity of just, hey, you know, it's going to come from somewhere, then, yeah, you might. I'm not saying the moment, I'm sure it's like, oh. And then you're back in the game. And each time with that same freshness and that same Christmas morning, feeling like, I wonder if this is going to be the one. Hey, let's talk. And it's not fake. It's not an act. It's not, okay, let me remember what it was like on Christmas morning. Okay, let me see what I saw, hear what I heard, feel what I felt. Okay, let me, okay, now let me visualize myself. That's what I used to do all day long, right? Okay, I'm going to now take that feeling with me into the sales situation. And I'm going to see them responding well. I used to work so hard to replicate what the mind does naturally. And, you know, it most of the time I think that's funny, and sometimes it really pisses me off.
I'm Gregory. That reminded me of a story I'm fond of, and two quick quotes that I just touched in. One was, I think it's from the autobiography of a yogi, the Paramahansa Yogananda book. There's a moment where, as I recall, one of his students, when he was first setting up a center here, I don't know if it was the Self-Realization Fellowship at Lake Shrine in the Palisades, but his student had been asked to find a location so that they could have a center. They didn't have a lot of students, but they were starting to teach classes. And So his student comes back to him and he says something to the effect of, well, I've got good news and bad news. The good news is I found an amazing location. It's absolutely gorgeous. There's a lake. The energetic there is incredible. And I think this is in the 30s, in the 1930s. He said, but the bad news is it's like $165,000. And, you know, I don't know where we're going to get that kind of money. And Paramahansa Yogananda, according to the story, he's just beaming. And he says, that's easy. The money will come from wherever it is now. And the other one that that your story reminded me of was this Mary Morrissey quote, coach who I discovered online a few months ago. And she has a seminar series, I think it's called The Dream Builders, something to that effect. And I was looking at the quotes on her page, and there was one that jumped off that really spoke to me, and it was something to the effect of, we can't make our dreams come true, but we can make our dreams more welcome. Mm-hmm. And that spoke to me. There's something about your letting go of ideas or concepts about strategizing or how am I gonna, but just kind of availing yourself and allowing that allowed for the wisdom and the unfoldment to happen in an organic, in a gracious, welcoming way that it touches my heart, because as a relatively new coach, my experience in coaching sessions, I was sharing this with Steph over lunch, that I'm finding that with all of the techniques and support strategies and communication skills, which I treasure and which I value and I see as really valuable, at the same time, there's a place inside of me that I'm finding more and more where I reside inside myself, in a place where I can receive whoever's sitting in front of me, and allow helps, as I've experienced as a client with my own coach and with therapists over the years. It's like, to the extent to which they've been able to receive me, it's modeled for me how to receive myself, and also how to receive the wisdom that's present and available to me. So just feel like what you were talking about speaks to the integrity of being a receptive container or a vessel. That's how it speaks to me.
You know, when Oliver came back from school a couple weeks ago, we were talking and he asked me about creating the impossible and what I'd learned from running this program for a few years now. And I said, the biggest thing that I've learned is when it's not about you, creating's pretty easy. And when it's not about you, coaching's pretty easy. And when it's not about you, building a business is pretty easy. And when it's not about you, having a great life is pretty easy. It's really difficult when it's about me, because I only exist in thought. That me that I'm trying to make it about is made of thought. It's in that upper realm on Dickens' drawing, right? So any time that my creation, my coaching, my work, my relationships become about me, well, there's going to be conflict, there's going to be difficulty, there's going to be problems. Any time I'm able to just allow spirit to come into form, allow the oneness to become many in a new way, that's what it does all day long. That's its nature. That's not hard. I don't know exactly what it's going to look like. I don't know exactly what form it will take. Sometimes it's the form I think. Sometimes it's nothing like the form I think. But if it's all got to fit, if the energy of the entire universe has to fit through this little tiny anus of a space before it can come into form, it's not going to be quite what it could be, and it might stink a bit. Right? It's a horrible metaphor, isn't it? Accurate, but horrible.
So I'm free to call you a sphincter from now on?
Yes.
I am the great sphincter of creation. Should we take a break on that note?
Yeah.
All right.
Definitely.
Take
a potty
folks.
Break.
Yeah.